Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to another rebroadcast from the RTB Archives. Hello and welcome to Recall This Book. This is John Plotz, today your solo host traveling the globe, at least as far as Southern Ohio, to bring you an interview with the filmmaker Mike Lee, a seven-time Oscar nominee, winner of various BAFTA awards, born Manchester in 1943, and making remarkable films for almost half a century now. So who's your favorite Mike Lee? Is it the sly comic genius who condenses ordinary life into unforgettable vignettes? That would be something like Life is Sweet or High Hopes or Naked. Or do you go instead for the grit, the squalor, and awkwardness of what it means to be stuck in class-based social misery or to try to fake your way out of it? That would be films like Abigail's Party, Nuts in May, Meantime, Hard Labor. Or how about his more recent period films? He calls them that in contrast to what he calls the chocolate box style of history filmmaking. Those would be films like Topsy Turvy and Mr. Turner, which reveal that even such lauded 19th century artists as Gilbert and Sullivan had ordinary lives worth depicting in their banality. If you're still drawing a blank, Google him and I'll bet you find a film that you want to watch right away. I'll wait. Well, no, actually, I won't wait, but you do have something to look forward to after this interview. So when he and I sat down to talk at a Victorianist convention in Columbus, Ohio, no less, our conversation ranged from method acting to movies I'd never seen that should have, to improvisation and John Cassavetes to when you can say fuck on British TV. Turns out to be after 9 p.m. And that's only the first 20 minutes. He also talked about James Thurber and effortlessly shot down my feeble question about close-ups. His point, which I thought was actually very compelling, was that he's more interested in making a world for the viewer than he is making a series of well-composed shots. So the way he put it is it's neither slice of life nor is it just a shot confection. Instead, it's something in between. But our conversation began with his mourning the absence of ordinary sound of working class voices from the 19th century. Why only famous people?
What fascinates me about this is, of course, that this is really interesting, which came up in research for various historical things, is that they recorded famous people. And it really took ages for anyone to spot that it would be good to record ordinary people.
Yeah.
So the archive, there are all these very early recordings of famous people sort of rather formally saying things or reading things or whatever. Yeah.
I like the Browning because he forgets the words in the middle, so it becomes informal.
Yeah. Actually, you know, when you start digging around for Vox Pop, you know, it took them ages to, and really, even the BBC up till World War II was still, if they had made documentaries about, for the radio, about ordinary people, they'd write down speeches for them to read out.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Although there are recordings in the National Sound Archive. I mean, when we were researching Mr. Turner, Marion Bailey, who plays Mrs. Booth, found these recordings, because obviously she was a woman from Kent, found these recordings of very old guys recorded in the 1920s
yeah.
talking this Kentish dialect, which she found very useful, which we built into some of what she, how she talks yeah. and what she said.
You know, when you say that, I remember there used to be these BBC accent records. Like, I feel like my mom took
That's
them
right.
home.
Yeah. But it's fascinating that those very early, late 19th century recordings
yeah.
only recorded famous people. It never occurred to anyone to go into the street and pick up Vox Pop.
So did you see that Peter Jackson movie about World War?
Yeah,
it's amazing, isn't it?
Very
what he
good.
Does.
Yeah. Really good.
Yeah. But he doesn't have the voices. He just has the lip readers.
Of course. But but a lovely job, actually.
But it's crazy to think about that you would have accurate visual capture of people, but you wouldn't have their...
It never occurred to anyone. You know, yeah. It's extraordinary, you know. Yeah. And the amount of footage of... ordinary people doing ordinary things on film.
Right. I mean, people leaving a factory at Lululemon.
Oh,
yes.
Everything.
Yeah, the actualities.
I mean,
yeah.
We did, when we sat down to do Topsy Turvy, the BFI gave us 2 hours of footage shot in and around London between 1896 and 1901.
Wow.
And there was 2 hours of it. It's a massive amount. People got, I mean, you know, the thing was only invented in 1896, within minutes, it seemed, people had cameras all over the show.
I went and looked at that same footage. I was writing a book about crowds in the 19th century, looked to
you
the BFI. Yeah, I saw some of that.
I mean,
it's amazing.
Massive amounts of it.
Totally.
And, you know,
yeah.
They filmed everything, and it never occurred to anyone to record. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Actually, you know, that leads into one question I wanted to ask you, Mike, which was about, for you, the differences between your TV films and your films. Like, were the TV films... Does that category make sense? I mean, things like Nuts in May.
What's the question?
Well, the question is, like, formally, was that different? I mean, was it, it wasn't tape versus film or anything
no,
like that?
No. The only things I did on tape were those studio productions, Abigail's Party and The Permissive Society, which were 5-camera studio jobs.
Uh-huh.
But everything else was on film. So they were films. I mean, we didn't obviously make them to the same motion picture standards that we would... with a 35mm feature film,
right.
Of course. But...
Does that mean you were using 16mm?
Oh, it was on 16mm. Yeah. But then we even Vera Drake was shot on Super 16, believe it or not, because of the quality we could get. No. They were films, and I regard them as films.
As films.
And nothing about them fundamentally was any different from making a movie, really.
And were you caught up in any TV constraints? Like in America, you know, it goes hour by hour, but I guess in Britain, like the TV slots. They didn't tell you it has to be 92 minutes exactly or anything like that.
No, they did, but they were very, very fluid about it, actually. So, I mean, like 4 Days in July, which is my film about Northern Ireland, was supposed to be, I think, 75 minutes, and it was actually 96 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And they made a fuss for about 2 seconds.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the fact was, unlike ITV, where they had commercial breaks and all of that, like here, it didn't really matter, and it was actually flexible. And the only constraint of a censorial nature was that you couldn't say fuck.
Mm-hmm.
But
you could show abortions, for example. That was all right.
I never.
Oh, I mean,
I'm talking about my television films in the early days.
Well, yeah, but in Hard Labor, I just mean you don't show an abortion, but I mean that the fact
in Hard
that,
Labor that isn't. What abortion?
Oh, what am I?
Well, they talk about it.
Talk about it.
Yeah,
sorry.
But no. But you couldn't say fuck. The first film I made where anybody said fuck was Meantime, which was made for Channel 4.
Yeah.
And we knew what time it would go out, and therefore by what stage in the film after the it was a 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock hour. Uh-huh.
You know. Yeah. But of course, now you can say whatever you want.
Yeah. Basically. I was going to ask you about Meantime. It's such an unbelievable cast in there. Was that like Tim Roth's first? Was that his first film?
Second.
Wow. Did you do his first as well? Or?
No. He was in a film with that Alan Clarke made called Made in Britain. Just before that, and that's really how I found him. Alan Clarke said, "This guy's this kid's good. Yeah, no, I mean, there were actors from here. And Gary, if the question is, did we know Gary Oldman's brother? We didn't know they were going to become megastars.
Yeah. But I guess the more general question is, like, how you think you've got, there's some people who you have worked with for film after film, and then others just a couple of films.
Yeah. And sometimes one, you know.
Yeah. And did you always, was that always the idea? Or did
No, it's not an idea. Yeah. It's not a project or it's not a, that's not a policy. It's just the way it starts to happen. I mean, you know, you work with someone and they're really good and you click and they are versatile, and because they're all character actors that I work with.
Yeah.
And so you go for it again. And so in some cases, again and again and again. But there's no construct in it. I mean, and there are people that I've worked with and want to work with again, and every time I'm doing something, they're not available, you know, and so on and so forth. And there isn't a film of mine where you don't see somebody that I've never worked with before being brilliant, you know. Not least young actors.
Yeah.
You know? So it's not, there are no, there's no policy in it at all, actually. I mean, people talk about, you know, the ensemble. It's all rubbish, basically.
Okay.
People come and go, and, you know.
Because I know a young filmmaker from Argentina who I think, inspired partly by you, has just an ensemble that he works with.
Well, that's... I understand that, you know, a family form. There is a kind of...
that's what it feels like with his films.
There is a sort of... There's obviously a... It isn't for me to talk about, but there is a sort of, I suppose, a kind of inner sanctum of people who have worked with Mike Lee, you know, because we do stuff that doesn't happen if you on any other kind of film, you know, in the nature of the thing.
Yeah.
It's sustained and long, and people are really, really have to do it. There's no messing about with it.
Yeah.
But it's not, not only do I resist the notion of an ensemble, but actually most I resist it only because it simply isn't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, if some force or authority said, okay, here are these 10 actors, and you could only ever make films with these 10 actors, I would regard it as a remarkably constraining, actually.
Yeah.
It has no inherent virtue at all. I mean, I can understand theatre companies of certain kinds for whom that has a kind of logic. But in the nature of what I do, it just doesn't make any sense, because it depends what you want to make a film about, really.
Well, has it ever been the case that something happened during a single one film that then triggered on to, like, the next film? Where you're like, oh, right, we can't explore this in this film, but then...
No. You mean in terms of the content, the ideas?
Content.
No. Well, no. And in fact, you can see by looking at the films that they are, whilst they're all tarred with the same brush, they all are pretty different from each other in all sorts of ways. No, that simply doesn't occur because, you know, each... that again, that's the same thing, really. It's that, you know,
that's the family,
I mean, you know, each film is a new proposition, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and all sorts of considerations come in, arise when you are, when you have the freedom to have... you know, a blank canvas, afresh each new time, because then you can sort of, because you see, in the end, I think this is probably the one of the underlying points about what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Is I'm not concerned in the first analysis with, you know, the nature of the ensemble or the nature of it. I'm concerned with the subject matter. I'm concerned with the world out there. And so when I look in that direction, there's that film. I look in this direction, there's another film. And so to be constrained by either trying to relink that film with this one, or, you know, trying to keep the same actors or whatever, those would be distractions and a red herring, really.
So in terms of the world...
Just one other thing about the actors thing is that apart from anything else, we are blessed in the UK with an incredible resource of actors, and there are too many actors to ever get around to, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, and that's the truth of it, you know, and there's several hundred more each year, you know, from the drama school. So, I mean, the idea of sort of confining it to just a few actors in an exclusive way would be eccentric.
You started out, did you intend to be an actor when you started at RADA?
No. No, I wanted to know about
stuff. I see. So even at like 17 or 18, you knew it wasn't for you.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, insofar as one can report that at 17 or 18, I knew exactly. I mean, you know, my journey to RADA at the age of 17 with a amazingly with a scholarship that actually, yeah. you know, was as much as anything to escape. Yeah. to escape home and escape yeah. Manchester and yeah. then get to London and do yeah. all that. And, you know, and to escape the pressure of that was put on for to be academic. You know, it was the one thing you could do where you didn't need academic right. qualifications. You just yeah. had to pass the, right. the audition. And I'd been in plays, I'd put on shows, I'd written yeah. stuff, I'd, you know, edited by that time two different magazines, uh-huh. I drew cartoons, I did all of that, you know, and I mean...
Were you aware of, like, the Angry Young Men and all that stuff?
Well, yes. I remember drawing a caricature of an angry young man to advertise the School Literary and Debating uh-huh. Society. Uh-huh. But, you know, I mean... I was 13 when Look Back in Anger happened. So you kind of knew it was happening, but you didn't quite get, you weren't on it completely. Yeah.
Was it all London or did it have like a northern life as well?
It did, but I mean, again, you know, things filtered through and you read the paper and whatever. But anyhow, the main thing was, but I knew it was all about making things up and writing it. I mean, I didn't, I suppose if I think about it, I don't know that I ruled out being an actor, but I within minutes of being at RADA, I knew that it was about directing, and not least because RADA was rubbish at that time. I mean, it was old. No, it was. It was old-fashioned, stale. Uh-huh. You did plays. You didn't discuss the plays. You learnt the lines. Yeah. You learnt the moves. You didn't fall over the furniture. You never discussed what is this. And there was no story of discussion about backstory. There was no improvisation and all of that.
Yeah.
And it took minutes to start to react against that. So it was immensely useful from that point of view. You know. And also, I mean, I hit town in September 1960. Well, I mean, the zeitgeist was about to erupt.
Yeah.
You know? No, we're talking about 19. I mean, Shadows was playing... Yeah. As I arrived.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
The Nouvelle Vague was on the go. Yeah. You know, Peter Brook was starting to do his
Peter Brook,
stuff.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and then there were, of course, before too long, there were, you know, happenings and all the rest of that stuff going on. And it was all happening in art. You know, I mean, I remember arriving in London and within a week, in the first week, going to the great Picasso exhibition at the Tate, which was a mind blower. And then here's the other thing, which is really important. Up to that point in time in Manchester, and I went to the movies all the time as much as possible from the earliest age.
Yeah.
And I saw...
And that being mostly Hollywood or...
All Hollywood.
All Hollywood,
Or British movies.
Yeah.
I never saw a film that wasn't in English.
Yeah.
And within a week of being in London, somebody said, there's showing a film at this arts festival. And it was this extraordinary film about the, you know, this knight playing chess with...
Oh, so you saw The Seven Seals.
Yeah.
And
I mean, like, you know,
was there like a voiceover or something? Or how did they do it? Or subtitles?
Subtitles.
No.
But I mean, the point was, you know, we're in London. Of course, I discovered world cinema, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So it didn't, the issue of directing and making stuff was not, was there to be, it was obvious, you know. Yeah. And by the time I left the thing, I'd put on a production of The Caretaker by Pinter, and which I also designed, you know, and you know, that's what it was about. And then I went on and I acted a bit. I very usefully found myself in a movie, a feature film.
I saw that on your Wikipedia page.
Two Left Feet. And it was, what was great, I had a very minor role, but I used to go every day. They used to say, "We haven't called you, you're not in this." I said, "I'm just here, you know, to watch." And it was fantastic. I mean, you know, it was an old-fashioned studio movie directed by Roy Ward Baker, who famously directed Titanic. And it was simply... then I went to Camberwell Art School on the Foundation course for a year. I did a year in the Theatre Design School of the Central School of Art, and I went to the London Film School at night time. And so I did all that. And then I started to make plays.
Was there snobbery in the theatre world? Like, we wouldn't touch film with a 10-foot pole kind of thing? Or were people always looking to get into film? Like, was there a fluid boundary between theatre and film, or a stiff
one? I mean, I would say so. I mean, of course, you have to reflect on what we mean. See, no, there was, because in fact, we're talking about the early 60s. Therefore, we're talking about the age of the period of the British New Wave. Lindsay Anderson, Carol Rice, Tony Richardson, John Schlesinger, etc. Now, those guys, first of all of those films, and this is incidentally why I never felt completely personally at one with what they were. What was great as they were looking at working class life, what was, however, the case was that all of those films, without exception, were adaptations of either plays from the Royal Court Theatre, or novels.
Yeah.
There were no, you know, whereas, so whilst looking at those and digesting those, you know, one was also looking at, for example, Abu de Souffle, which, of course, is, you know, as it were, painted on the canvas. You know, it's film.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot to think about. You know, but so as to the fluidity between theatre and film, no, I mean, the Royal Court Theatre and Woodfall Films, who made all those films, were the same guys, really.
You know?
So there was, you know, people, you know, I don't think there was, I don't think there was a snobbery particularly. I mean, there might have been, it was with some very old fashioned people who will have taught us at the academy. But, you know, I mean, even the oldest of them, movies had been around as long as they had. I mean, you know, we were taught in the first term by a woman called Nell Carter, who's that little old bird.
Is Radha now.
Radha.
Yeah.
Who had played Juliet in Henry Irving's last season at the Lyceum in 1899.
Yeah, talk about Victorian connections. Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean,
wow.
You know, and of course, you know, she was no radical director, you know. It was about sort of, it was very, very square.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But movies wouldn't have been a novelty to her. Yeah. I mean, you know, they were happening when she was little. You know?
Right. So can I ask about those British New Wave? I've read about the Cassavetes connection for you, but I was wondering.
Well, I mean, in passing, just to round that off. I mean, the fact of Shadows, particularly, at the moment one discovered it, was it had, in inverted commas, been improvised. And that was a radical and remarkable thing.
Yeah.
In passing, though it's not in the drift of what you obviously going to want to talk about, but in passing, I mean, my, whilst things like the murder of a Chinese bookie, for example, is that what it's called?
Yeah, I can't agree.
I mean, I've got a lot of respect for Cassavetes, but on the other hand, not always, because quite a lot of the time, what you are looking at are actors playing themselves and improvising on camera and letting their own shit hang out, as opposed to really depicting the world.
Yeah.
And although, I mean, it's got its own kind of dynamic quality, I've sort of part company with it to a considerable extent, because obviously what I'm concerned with is not raw acting, you know, revealing its innards, improvising in front of the camera. It's about distilling the world and making something very precise, which isn't about actors, it's about the world.
You know? Can I ask it that? I sort of had an inchoate question about it. It seems like, looking at your education, that there was a period of method acting training, right? Was it the East 15 school? No?
No, I didn't train. I taught there.
Oh, you taught there?
Some people have written that I've trained there. That's rubbish.
I'm glad you said that. Well, I'll correct Wikipedia.
No,
then.
I mean, I know. There's such a lot of rubbish in Wikipedia. I don't know who puts it there. By the time I went, that school came out of Joan Littlewood's stuff.
Right.
And I went and taught there and made a play there with them as well in 1968.
Oh, okay.
I'd already been an assistant director at the RSC and all sorts of stuff.
Method and you have nothing in common, really. You don't have a...
No, I mean, of course one thought about it and knows about it, but I mean, if you want to talk about that, I mean, it's very straightforward. The idea of the actor finding the character within himself or herself.
Marlon Brando.
That's what they all do. And then sort of living it, becoming the character and all that, is as far down the other end of the spectrum from what I do with actors as you can get.
Yeah.
Because what I'm concerned with is that they are people very much are able to play all sorts of different people, and when they play somebody, they totally are able to go into character and be in character, but they are able, with a discipline, to come out of character so they can be objective about the character, so we can then work with the material.
Yeah.
And also, it's bad for you to sort of, particularly if it's a character who is traumatized, to become the character. It's rubbish, basically. Yeah. Makes no sense. So in that sense, I absolutely, whilst I respect the integrity and the intentions of and the spirit of the actor studio, I completely, on a practical and philosophical level, part company from it.
This feels related to me. You might not think it's related, but can I ask you, one of the things that I love about really all your films, but especially those early ones, is the power of close-ups, the way you use close-ups, I mean, to just kind of sit with someone's face while they're experiencing something. Is that, I mean, do you think of that as
No. I mean, you know, there is no, again, there's no kind of aesthetic or dramatic or cinematic agenda about this.
Yeah.
You know, when it needs to be in a close-up, it's a close-up.
Okay.
It needs to be a long shot, it's a long shot. And if it needs to track, it tracks. And if it doesn't, there's no reason for the camera to move, it stays still.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all there is to be said about it. Yeah. I mean, I have no philosophy of the close-up.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I don't think it, with respect, I don't think it's especially accurate or true to talk about the earlier films in relation to the close-ups, which implies that we don't have close-ups in the later films.
No.
I mean, if you think about the opening shot of Another Year, for example, on Imelda Staunton, that's a massive close-up without anything preceding it, and you're thrown into this woman's crisis, and you misled into thinking this is a film about this woman, and you don't hardly see her again.
Yes.
No. I mean, there is no, I have no, you know, it's the language of film. And it's there, it's like, in a similar way, Russian Ark notwithstanding, which has got his own logic. I mean, apparently it would seem that Sam Mendes, produced by Steven Spielberg, has just made a film, which is just finished, called 1917, about the First World War, and it's all in one shot.
Jesus.
Yeah. Now, you think, oh, wow, how cinematic.
Have you seen Russian Ark? I've never seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You've never seen it?
No, is it worth...
When you do see it,
it's
worth getting hold of it and the documentary about making it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, it's essential viewing. It's
it
mad.
Is. Okay.
It's mad, but it's...
It seems so mad. Yeah.
No, but anyway, but here's the thing, and this is related to this, the question of a fetish about close-ups.
And that's your word, not mine.
It is. No, but I mean, I refer to it as something that you may have been inadvertently accusing me of.
Yeah,
you know? If you say, well, and I've fallen into this trap on a few occasions, you say, I know what would be great if we make all this work in a single tracking shot. And you think, oh, that's great. You know, yeah, that takes to that. And so he moves there and then, oh, it's great. We can make that. You know, there's a line, a danger line that you cross where you suddenly know that what you are now doing in constructing is to justify the shot.
The shot, right. I see. You're letting the shot drive.
And of course, in no time you realize that what you're putting together is bullshit, basically.
Yeah.
Because actually, if you simply create the action and then decide how to shoot it, that's what it's all about. So that I talk about that in the same breath as... the idea that there is a thing about close-ups, or, you know...
I hear what you're saying.
You could argue, you know, wouldn't it be great to make a film where everything's in a long shot? What does that mean, you know?
Yeah.
Some things are in long shot, and some things you need to get in there and share. You know?
Yeah, no, I hear you. That makes sense. Hey, can I say, my friend that you had dinner with last night, Ivan, told me that you're going to go visit the Thurber House.
Yeah.
Are you a Thurber fan?
I have been all my life.
Me too, yeah.
All my life.
Yeah. Drawings and stories?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I was told that there's apparently a statue of a unicorn outside in the garden, well, that's great. And I love that cartoon that they made in the 1950s of the unicorn in the garden, which...
I've seen it, no.
Oh, it's online, you can find it.
That's amazing, yeah, I will, yeah.
It's a famous animation.
Yeah.
But that simply was done in the style of his drawings. It's fantastic.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And, you know.
Because I think the movie of Secret Life of Walter Mitty is good, but it doesn't feel like Thurber at all.
No, it's not. And why would it be? And why should it be? And how could it be? I mean, Thurber exists on the page.
On the page,
of course. But I mean, you know... everything, including, you know, the 13 clocks and the wonderful earth and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Those
are childhood memories for
me. Yeah. I mean, in fact, my cousin, long since dead, sadly, adapted the 13 clocks for the BBC radio way back.
Wow.
When he was quite young and they did it. But yeah, and the cartoon, I mean, you know, the great achievement of a man who was half blind who couldn't draw.
Totally. Yeah.
There's these fantastic drawings.
Absolutely. You know? That's kind of what I wanted to ask you, actually. Because, yeah. I mean, the writing is unbelievable and the relationship to Mark Twain is fascinating. Yeah. But yeah. But the drawing, the way the drawing comes from, yeah, more than half blind, I think. Yeah.
But it's
and getting blinder as he drew.
Yeah. But it's the actual, it's his world that really one resonates with.
Yeah.
Right, what have you done with Dr. Melmos?
Exactly, right. And that would be the first Mrs. whatever.
Oh, yeah. Like sitting up on the phone. Yeah. What do you mean you heard a seal bark?
Yeah. But they work well. I mean, my dad used to read them out loud to me when I was a kid.
Oh,
I mean, they work. They don't just work on the page. They work as a voice as well.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
No, good. I look forward to that.
So that the another question I had for you was kind of other art forms you think about. And you do drawing yourself, right? And have always done?
Well, I mean, I'm very lazy about it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when I went to art school, I can draw. And I, you know, I actually, in a parallel universe, I probably would have been a cartoonist.
Mm.
But that isn't should never be misreported as being... I was a cartoonist, isn't
right.
true? I mean, I drew. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very... and my son is a very successful illustrator.
Oh, wow.
One of my sons, the other one's a filmmaker.
Huh.
Toby Lee is the illustrator.
Mm.
But, you know, I'm into all sorts of stuff. I mean, I saw a documentary in the London Film Festival literally a week ago. Miles Davis, The Birth of the Blues, which I heartily recommend.
Mm.
Terrific. Stuff. I mean, they talk to everybody, including all these various women. And, and there's lots of recording sessions and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, I just kind of love all that, you know.
Yeah. So does the drawing ever figure into the film? Like, do you ever draw for set design or anything like that? No.
Oh, no. No. I work with... I mean, actually, interestingly, you should say that, because in the early period when I was developing the so-called misnamed improvised play...
Yes. What name do you prefer then?
Well, I only say that because, I mean, sometimes people talk about devised, but, you know, the real point is, well, this is another matter.
Okay.
For years, I used to put, as you know, you've probably seen, devised and directed, and I changed it to written and, because that is really what I do. I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And it's only that it's... I changed it because it's more accurate, but also to avoid confusion, so that people don't actually think it's... just a committee job, which it isn't. However, for the first sort of number of years when I put on plays in the on the sort of fringe theatre before I could get to make movie and before it got better and it got better scope, better projects to do, and it was done very cheaply. I also designed my own shows. Then I started to work with designers. I work with the designers and they do all, you know, I don't do that.
So I was sort of wondering if you know, in terms of there's all these films that have inspired you. Are there other sorts of artwork that inspire you?
Like, well, that's what you're asking me.
Yeah.
I mean,
you've never done an adaptation. That's not your métier. That's not your.
I'm not interested.
Yeah.
There's no point.
Yeah.
And
I really take that point about that being one of the ways you're pushing yourself off from the new wave.
Oh, you know, that's what people. You know, other people can do that.
Yeah.
I have to say. That the number of adaptations in existence that are really, really any good is very small, I think.
And the best ones aren't really adaptations, they're versions or something.
Well, that's as may be. You know, I suppose if I was really going to be a fascist, I would ban all adaptations.
Really? But then you'd kill Tarkovsky. He'd have nothing.
Well, there you go. Well, you can't win them all. Tarkovsky was very nice when we were... struggling to get Bleak Moments, my first film, shown in Moscow.
Yeah.
Tarkovsky was very, very helpful and instructive, just in passing.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, about 9 months ago, I was in a conversation and the name of Philip Roth came up.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, yeah, Philip Roth. I read Portnoy's Complaint. And I thought, I've only ever read Portnoy's Complaint.
Yeah.
So in the last number of months, I've got pretty nearly only read... been reading, getting my way through all of Philip
Roth.
That's
awesome.
And, you know, it's just terrific.
You know, I just interviewed Zadie Smith about a month ago, and she talked about Philip Roth for about 15 minutes.
There
she's just obsessed
and
with
him. And she's good. I like her.
She is good. Yeah.
I like her.
I like her. Yeah. So I'm not asking about adaptation. It's more like things that, you know, artworks that have like really spoken to you.
I the trouble with this question, you sort of go blank and never know where to start, really.
Yeah. No, but Philip Roth is a great one.
I get a fantastic buzz out of Hopper, for example.
Yeah.
But you can understand that.
Yeah.
You're familiar with this town, are you?
Yeah.
So I went and spent a couple of hours in the cartoon.
The Billy Island Cartoon Museum. Yeah. Fantastic. I was going to ask you about that, actually. That's great.
What a blow of a place. It's fantastic.
It is fantastic, And also the way it takes cartoons back to the early 19th century, too. Those German books.
Also, I mean, you know, when we were working on Peterloo, I mean, it was just a gas to go back to territory I already was into, which is like Gilray and Rowlandson's early that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know where to start. I mean, I mean, a lot of art. I mean, obviously, Turner played an important part.
Yeah. And is that a long-standing thing for you? I mean, have you always loved Turner paintings before you thought I could do a film about him?
For a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, I never noticed or was aware of Turner as a kid growing up. I mean, on my wall as a teenager were postcards of, you know, Picasso and Toulouse-Lautrec and at that early stage you thought, oh, surrealism is great, you know.
Yeah.
Salvador Dali more seriously than I would take him now.
The clocks. I was in college, everyone had the clocks.
And then I think probably insofar as, I mean, I have no recollection of Turner registering, but I think it wouldn't have done, because I wouldn't have been perceptive enough to distinguish Turner from boring landscape painting, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then I was at art school, and I shared a place with a few guys, and one guy, who's remained a close friend, had a big reproduction of Fighting Temerin on the wall. And then one started to go into the Tate and look at the Tate.
Yeah.
And he suddenly started to twig it and sort of think, this isn't just any old landscape painting. This is something else.
You're lucky to have the Tate to have that happen to you. Both for Blake and Turner.
Yeah,
like absolutely. I don't know where else that could happen.
No, of course. But the point is, you know, things, I mean, you know, whether you're talking about George Grosz or Otto Dix or you're talking about Brecht and Weill.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, there's so much stuff that, you know, and of course, there is cinema. I mean, you know, of course, Olmi didn't make The Tree of Wooden Clocks until 1978, by which time I was well up and running.
Yeah.
But, you know, that film is a massive blowaway as far as I'm
concerned. I've never seen it. Okay.
Oh, I can't believe that.
I'm an idiot. What can I say?
Well, I mean, I don't know whether you're an idiot, but you're certainly missing a trick or two.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You know, it's an amazing thing. Okay. So it's not, I can't say Olmi is an influence in any strict sense. And it's hard to talk about influences as such.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, I was definitely influenced by Beckett and Pinter. But as I say, you know,
can I just say Beckett is fascinating in that sentence? Because I think of Beckett as leaving everything out, whereas everything you're describing about your ethos is to try to get it in, like to...
But then, of course, the job is to distill it.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have to bend over backwards to see a kind of... See Beckett's influence somewhere along the line if you look at Bleak Moments.
Yeah.
I'm sure you see.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is about... It's pretty distilled.
It's not slice of life. It's not just run.
It's not
right.
Slice of life is not what I do.
Yeah.
But also Bleak Moments particularly. I mean, there are longer silences in Bleak Moments than any production of Endgame. I don't know. It's hard. There's so many things. And then apart from anything else, I mean, you know, I spend a huge amount of time listening to classical music.
But can we circle back to Philip Roth? Because that's really interesting to me. Like that's,
yeah, but you understand that I've only spent the last 9 months.
9 months, I know. I'm not saying it's an influence. I'm just trying to, I'm interested in what resonates with you. Like how much what his novels do. I mean, he's an ensemble writer in a way, because his same characters keep coming back. You know?
Yes, no, that's his thing. You know, yeah. that is what's interesting.
That is what's interesting. And of course, Ghost comes and then Exit Ghost.
Yeah, and also to do the thing he does, which is a whole different ball game, which is to dramatize himself in, you know, and dish himself up in different guises, but it's still him, and I mean, you know, on the whole, I'm not interested in films about films.
Right.
And the only exception in my work is Topsy Turvy, which is a film about theatre. So, you know, I read Roth and think, well, yeah, but this isn't writers writing about writing. But that's his prerogative.
Yeah.
And the real point is, what does he do? What's it about humanity? You know.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, I come from a Jewish background.
Yeah.
You know? And so there are things that are in there that just sort of resonate with the world I grew up
in. I saw you've done a play that sort of speaks to Jewish things.
Yeah, so yeah. 2000 years.
Yeah.
Yes, it did. In 2005 at the National Theatre.
Yeah.
But Roth, that world.
Yeah.
Sometimes, quite often, in fact, resonates with at certain levels. With it. You know, you recognize some of the characters.
No, but the connection I was trying to make was that you were saying, in a way, even though Topsy Turvy is, in a sense, I think you could call it a period piece, but it comes out of a life that you feel like you know.
Yeah, totally.
Not just in a historical way.
No, as I said last night, we were turning the camera around on what we do. We who make plays and films and entertain and take very seriously the job of entertaining other people with our trivia.
Yeah. You said profound trivia, which I like.
I always say that,
Well, what do you think? What does that mean to you when you say profound?
It's just cheeky. I mean, there's trivia and there's profound trivia.
Yeah.
You can work that out for yourself.
Can I ask what your new projects are now? Fair enough.
Not least because... most of my films and play, all of my plays, and most of them, which means all of them except Topsy Turvy, Mr. Turner, and Peter Lou, have all been projects where we've said nothing to anybody, including the backers. And we said, you know, give us the money and we'll go off and develop a film, and the film comes out of it.
Yeah.
They'll all be made like that. And the one I'm going to do next, whatever it is, will be no exception. So therefore, I'm not saying anything to anybody, but the reason I, in any case, can't precisely say, wouldn't be able to, even if I wanted to. I mean, there are millions of ideas going around in my head at any given moment, but it's because I don't know how much money I'm going to have.
Yeah.
And until I know that, I will only know the size of the scale of the canvas, and then I will be able to decide which direction to go in. But there's lots of possibilities.
Yeah.
There's no shortage of things to deal with in the world at the moment.
Yeah. So... does that mean you want to talk about Brexit, or do you not want to talk about Brexit?
I'll talk about Brexit at this moment.
I know, right now.
Even as,
like,
we speak.
As we speak. Yeah.
No, my partner Marion and her daughter have just sent me a picture of themselves at the rally.
Oh, at the rally.
Which is going on all around Parliament while it's all going on. I mean, by now it's probably over, I should think.
Yeah. I hear there's some Tories speaking at the rally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They will be. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
No. What is there to say about it? It is a 100% gilt-edged total disaster.
Yeah.
It should never have happened.
Yep.
It's a complete folly. It's a complete waste of time. It's the most destructive, dangerous disease, which will last for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And
whatever the result of this, it will last for decades?
Or... well, if it was cancelled.
Yeah.
And if...
second referendum
ordinary
or
relations
whatever.
Were restored.
Yeah.
You might be disposed to say, well, then everything will be back to normal. But of course it won't, because there'll be riots from the people that still ignorantly want to leave. But also a massive amount of time, effort, energy and money has been expended and wasted on the half possibility.
Yeah.
It's completely ridiculous and irresponsible on every level.
Do you take it as ridiculous and just like a mad folly that somehow happened, or do you take it as symptomatic of a direction that Britain and America are heading now?
Well, it's a direction in which the world is heading.
Yeah. That's what I fear. Yeah.
Well, it's a fact.
Yeah.
You know, there's no question about it. The rise of the far right,
the ethno-populist or ethno-nationalist
everywhere. Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, we are into, you know, I mean,
1930s territory.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, yeah. It's worse because we're in this age of mass communication.
Yeah.
To which the 30s bore no resemblance whatever.
Yeah.
And that's got a great deal to do with it.
Right. They have dissemination. Cafe, we have Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah. And beyond Twitter, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, welcome to the 21st century. You know, now, after nearly two decades, we find ourselves in what we now recognize is actually the 21st century.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I far from wanting to talk about Brexit, apart from not wanting to talk about Brexit, yeah. I mean, I think it is the, you know, it's a total and devastating disaster, really.
Yeah. Do you see are there any lights at the end of that tunnel? Anything about the 30s analogy that makes it look, no, nothing.
Well, you tell me what that
is. I don't know. I'm asking everyone that. I don't know. I mean.
It's hard to see it.
Yeah.
It's hard to see it. And, you know, as to Trump and all of that, I mean, you know, it's beyond. Thurber has this story about the greatest man in the world. Remember?
No, I don't remember.
It's called the greatest man in the world, and they built an aeroplane that will fly nonstop right around the world, and they're convinced it'll crash.
Yeah.
So they find a guy who's an idiot because they know it'll crash.
Yeah.
And they arrange an event to lament the fact that he's crashed.
Yeah.
In advance of it happening, and it flies around the world and it doesn't crash.
Yeah.
And so they have this reception, and of course he's there at the reception, and he behaves unbelievably badly and gropes all the women, and they think, you know, that we have to deal with this, and the crowd are outside, you know, thronging to see the hero.
Yeah,
and
it's a Lindbergh story in a way.
And so finally they conspire, and he goes out on the balcony, and they discreetly push him over the balcony, and plunges to his death.
Yeah,
and then they have the lamentation, the memorial that they had planned.
Yeah.
For some reason, I keep in the relation to Trump, I keep thinking about this. An idiot is projected into the chair, into the seat of power.
Yeah,
and behaves in a completely erratic and
right. The difference is everyone around him is plunging to their death. You know, like, because the entire circle gets destroyed, but he doesn't get destroyed. He's,
I know.
Do you know there's a character in Middlemarch who flourishes wonderfully on murdered men's brains?
Yeah.
I mean, I just, like, that's what he is. He's the saprophyte. Yeah.
But, you know, you've got children, have you?
Yeah, two teenagers, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, you've got teenagers.
They're furious at us.
Well, that's what I was going to say
absolutely.
I mean, we who have raised kids would know how to deal with Trump.
Yeah.
But somebody doesn't deal with him, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he is an indulged brat, you know.
Yeah. I got to say, our kids, though, take the Philip Larkin line, don't have any kids yourself. Like, they don't understand why we had kids. That's an unbelievable thing.
Well, they may
hear.
Get over it. You know?
They may get over it. I understand it's that's something that a 16-year-old says.
It's
but,
a thing
yeah.
you start when it started yeah. to hear.
I,
and
yeah.
it's, of course, you know, there's no, I mean, the number of new babies born during the course of the time we've been having this conversation would actually fill most of this hotel in the world.
Yeah.
And that's very depressing. On the other hand, you know, a world in which nobody gets born is the end of the world.
Yeah.
So it's hard to resolve this particular conflict. Yeah.
Well, I've always been a huge fan of science fiction since growing up, but I've noticed in the last 5 or 10 years, it's a lot more appealing to a lot more people than it used to be. And I think part of it is that notion of, like, we just feel like humanity has fucked everything up. So maybe there's some other answer, you know, either out there, or maybe we should just let the mold and the slime worms take over, the slime molds take over, you know, and the, you know, like at the end of the time machine when the thing with claws comes out.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. All right. Mike, thank you really a lot.
Not
I appreciate your time.
No, that's thank great. You. Yeah.
Recall This Book is the brainchild of John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. Music comes from a song by Eric Chaslow and Barbara Cassidy. Sound editing is by Claire Ogden. Website design and social media by Matthew Schratz. And on our website, as well as in the program notes on Stitcher or iTunes, you will find some footnotes to today's interview, including links to a bunch of Mike Lee films and various other works mentioned in the interview. We always want to hear from you directly with your comments, criticisms, or suggestions. Finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please be sure to forward it to friends and family, please, and write a review or rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. It makes a huge difference to us. We're very appreciative. You may be interested in checking out past episodes, including interviews with Samuel Delaney, Chinese sci-fi great Xishan Liu, and Zadie Smith, who needs no adjective. Upcoming episodes in our jam-packed fall include a conversation about scientific collaboration and why it's better than humanistic collaboration with the string theorist Albion Lawrence. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.